In today's episode, we look at National Grief Awareness Week. But what does that mean? Grief is a universal emotion triggered by various life events, most commonly the loss of a loved one. However, it can also stem from significant life changes such as the end of a relationship, job loss, or health challenges. According to statistics, nearly 70% of people will experience the loss of a close family member or friend by the age of 30, and it highlights the widespread nature of grief in our lives. National Grief Awareness Week encourages open discussions, education, and empathy to help individuals understand and cope with the many facets of grief. It is estimated that only about 30% of people actively seek professional help or counseling when dealing with grief, underscoring the need for increased awareness and support. Today, we look to discuss some of more difficult topics and how to embody our DC value, Be Kind, with our guest speakers, Diana Schumann, Head of Americas and Global Chief Sustainability Officer, Mark Thompson, Assistant Vice President, SRP, and Victoria Beckett, Internal Communication Manager. Hello, Mark, Victoria and Diane. Thank you so much for joining me today for this podcast. We're going to be talking about grief. And grief is often a topic shrouded in stigma and silence. So how can we break down these barriers and encourage open conversations about grief? Victoria, what do you think?
Thank you, Sylvia. So I always find this such an interesting one because I feel like apart from death, grief is one of those certainties in life that at some point all of us will go through in some capacity, whether that be via death or going through the stages of grief when a relationship ends or when a friendship ends. So it does surprise me that there is such a stigma attached, just because I always think stigmas come from people just don't know or they haven't experienced it. But I feel like everybody experiences grief. So it's a shame that that stigma does exist. I think it would help us all to talk about it more. But I think we're also in a new age of talking things out, okay? So I feel like post-war mentality was stiff upper lip, don't talk about the war, don't talk about trauma or anything that is perceived negative. So I think that's why people don't talk about it, because they feel that offloading unhappy or negative thoughts is seen as burdensome in some way. So I think people avoid the kind of heavier conversations because we want to put out this kind of projection that we're happy, positive people. But I think everybody goes through it. So I actually think there's a lot of benefit to talking about it.
I agree with you completely, Victoria. And beyond that, I think a conversation obviously is two ways. And I agree with you that often those of us who are experiencing grief are reluctant to engage in conversations on the topic because it'd be awkward for the other person, or it may, as you say, make you look a little bit weak or vulnerable. And folks are reluctant to do that. But I also think that because it is a two-way obligation, I think it is appropriate for those of us who are experiencing grief to invite others to talk to us about it. I know often when somebody is experiencing, you know, whatever the event is, whether it's a divorce or a death in the family or some other grief-initiated event, others feel awkward. How do I approach a conversation with that individual? What do I say? Is it appropriate to even acknowledge that I know about it? So I think there's a lot that can happen bilaterally to encourage more open conversations.
Do you think are there specific coping strategies or self-care practices that you'd recommend for those who are grieving?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things that will help people who are experiencing grief in a really acute way. I think, as I mentioned a moment ago, just talking about it and inviting other people into your space to talk about it, giving them the permission to give their point of view or their own coping strategies. I also think that it's a little bit of a cliche, but trying to remember whether it's, you know, a marriage that's gone sour or a death in the family or some other grief-initiated event, it's worth thinking about the happy times and not just thinking about how that person's life ended. But it is acute that the feelings of grief are very, very acute. They're physical, they're physiological, and acknowledging that someone's going through that and letting other people into your space, I think, is key.
I think that's a really interesting point. And I think for me, I don't think it's about telling people how to deal with their grief. I feel like it's such a unique journey. But yeah, maybe if you're the person who's in that advisory or listening role, just being more open and to say the difficult thing of, you know, do you want to talk about this, seek the permission? And the worst people are going to say is no. I always think when people are going through grief, you're very unlikely to make them feel worse unless you're being particularly insensitive, which I don't think many people go into conversations with that intention, but you might make somebody feel better. And I think if we can get comfortable with being a little bit uncomfortable, not knowing what to say, and asking the person in the position of grief to guide you a bit, actually, like saying, do you want to talk about it? And if they do, sit and offer them that space to have conversations, because it's all part of the healing process as well, is saying it out loud and processing it, and you're helping them through that process. But in terms of advice to grieving people, I think do what you need to do. If you're adopting particularly unhelpful habits, so if you're using, I don't know, substances as a way of coping, I would try and put a timeline on that as to how long that's viable for. I think it can help in the shock period, and certainly no judgment if people decide that they're going to drink more to help them sleep or get through that first stage. But I think if you identify that you're adopting unhealthier coping mechanisms, just to check in with yourself of how long you're willing to go down that path before you maybe look at healthier ways of processing.
And how have technology and social media affected the way people grieve and seek support? What are your thoughts on that, Mark?
Okay, so social media, it's just a bit fake, really. It gives people an unrealistic expectation of life, you know, in terms of lifestyles. But my own personal experience is that when my brother went missing 3 years ago, all I could think to do was to get on Facebook and contact everyone in my network to see who might live local to where he was living at the time. And you get a lot of people reaching out to you in that kind of situation. And people are generally well-intentioned and will try and help in any way that they can. So you can use social media in that way to achieve those particular ends. But I think it's just, it's kind of just making sure you kind of use it for the purpose it's intended. I don't think necessarily, I mean, people might use it as a platform to sort of talk about their grief, and I'm never going to say that's a bad idea. Yeah, it's just, like I said, it's the kind of the volume of nonsense that's online on these various social media apps is can sort of shroud and hide a positive message. So I think that it has pros and cons. I don't know which I'm more inclined to say is the greater, but, well, I guess I've used it to help with something that was grief related, as I explained, and it helped me kind of come to terms with the issue, and yeah, lots of people offer to help. So yeah, as long as it's used for its intended purpose, I think it can be a very positive thing. It's easy to slip into an old, less of a not fit for purpose thing.
I think I agree with Mark. It's certainly a double-edged sword, social media, because I think there's a lot of positives. It raises awareness. People speak more openly about grief. Other issues shrouded in stigma are kind of destigmatized via the ability to share it so freely. But what I've found going through my own grief journeys is the algorithm where your phone listens to what you're talking about. I might be talking about my grief in a moment or talking about the death I've experienced. I don't then want 15 quotes coming up on my Instagram on grief. So it can be quite triggering in that sense because I'm not seeking that out at that time. And then I don't know, quotes don't really work for me. I don't need a quote to put things into perspective. So I've actually found it quite triggering at times and made the decision to come off it because I might have wanted to have a 10-minute conversation with somebody in that moment. I then don't need 15, 20 posts on the complexities of grief because it can actually get quite burdensome and heavy. So yeah, I think social media breaks can also be quite useful depending on what stage you're at.
I was going to say in that situation, AI has to develop empathy before it can do that reliably, but ultimately it's just words. And yeah, the number of times I've been a bit taken aback and just, oh my God, this terrible. Why is my phone doing this to me?
But yes, same. Just not another quote, please.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Exactly.
What would you say were the most meaningful and memorable stories that of help or healing related to grief that you've ever encountered, Victoria?
So I've said this before. So my personal story is 6 years ago now, I lost my first daughter. She was stillborn. And more recently, my dad died from cancer in the last few months. And the two things where my friends and family have kind of rallied around to offer support, the thing that I found so useful, and it's such a practical thing, but it's one of those things when you're going through grief, you really don't want to think about, is bring food. It's one of the things where I'm like, actually, this is really useful, because I'm not convinced anybody can say, certainly in the first few months, there's not actually words that will make you feel better. It's nice to know people care. It's really important that people check in on you, but you're going to be sad. You should be. Like, death is rubbish. Like, that's okay to be sad. But it's actually doing the day-to-day things is incredibly overwhelming. Just really simple things like thinking about what you want for dinner. So if somebody comes around with a pot of food where you're just like, that's one less thing I have to achieve today. I found those practical things so useful. People taking away quite simplistic tasks that I just didn't have the capacity to deal with. So my response to that, if you want to be helpful, take food around.
That's great. That's very helpful. Thank you. What about you, Mark?
I completely agree in that regard. From an objective standpoint, or viewing things very subjectively at the time of grief, I've come to realize that the best way to deal with someone, or to deal with someone who's suffering from grief, is to just kind of be normal with them, as you would be normally. If they, you know, show them that they've got loads of friends who care, maybe you can go sort of a bit above and beyond to spend time with someone who's suffering from grief. But if you keep that kind of relationship normal, you know, if you were to treat someone who is in the grief process, like you said, they're bringing food around, or just calling them up and saying hi, you don't need to say, if you want to, you can call me about anything, and so on and so forth. If you show that person that you're a good and reliable friend for them in that situation, then they will come to you when and if they need it. So that's, I guess, the coping strategy would be to help someone with grief, treat them normally as you normally would, but show them that you're around and you care. And one lesson I learned a little while ago now, it was sort of, I think, like kind of grief following the breakdown of a marriage and the loss of that relationship there. Some people can just be quite, you know, introverted and keep all their feelings inside. I'm certainly one of them. I couldn't imagine myself talking to people about it. But one of my good friends said to me that if one of us, as in old school friends, came to you and asked for help, what would you do? And the answer is obvious. Of course I would help. And it's just fundamentally realizing what that actually means. It's difficult to navigate. As you say, Victoria, it's all rubbish, like, to have to deal with it. But just a sort of steady standard relationship with friends and so on is the best thing for the short term, or the near term.
I agree, Mark. And I think it's about continuing to turn up for people who are grieving. Because I think in that first part, it's quite natural to become reclusive and shut yourself off because you're processing such a myriad of emotions, really difficult emotions as well. There's a lot to unravel. And you don't want to go out and socialize. It's not what you want to do. You don't want to be in social situations, but you will get to a point where you're ready for that. And people just need to be patient, I think, with people who are grieving. We're such fixers. We want to fix our friends and family. We want to make the situation better as quickly as we can because we're uncomfortable with difficult feelings. But actually, you can't rush grief. You need to go through the sadness. You need to go through the depression. You need to go through the anger. You need to process each stage. And you need to be allowed the space to do that. And know at the end of that, that your constants are still there for you. I think that's how you can really support people, is just keep showing up.
And so what changes or improvements would you like to see in how society approaches and supports grief in the future?
It's a tough question because, as we've said earlier in this conversation, everyone deals with grief in their own personal way. And so there's no one panacea. I would say it's really around social norms and showing empathy and having the ability to really let people be vulnerable while they're experiencing grief, and also not be dismissive. I'm thinking of a good friend of mine who lives alone, lost his dog recently. Weeks, months later, he was still mourning the loss. And people were pretty dismissive, you know, like, well, it's just a dog. But it was genuine sincere grief that he was feeling. Even I lost my mom last year, and the first question people asked me was how old she was. And when I said she was 86, they said, oh, well, at least she lived a long life. And it just felt very dismissive. And I know they meant well, and they wanted to say something positive, but it wasn't helpful at all.
It's almost toxic positivity, isn't it, Diane? Because I feel like people do that. They try and minimize, okay, well, I won't be sad then.
Exactly.
It's so indicative of people are so uncomfortable with the facts and truths of people being sad. They just look for ways in their mind to placate it and make it feel better. But for the person on the receiving end, it can feel quite insulting.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I think from a societal standpoint, people need to be sensitive, more sensitive than they often are. And also, as Mark said, be there to provide support, whether it's your example, Victoria, of bringing food or just a listening ear or being part of a support group where you are sharing your feelings openly with someone who's experiencing the same thing that you are and benefiting from their own coping mechanisms. Again, from a societal standpoint, I don't think there is any panacea, but there's small things that can make a big difference.
Mike, what are your thoughts on how society approaches and supports grief?
Well, I think I'm a little bit of a cynic here. It's like society is such a broad term. How does anyone affect that kind of change in society? Now, I know that's not technically what the question is asking, but I don't think there's anything really kind of society can do. The only thing there is reducing the stigma around it, the stigma around grief and mental health issues, which usually takes a few pioneers to show everyone else that it's okay to talk about these things. Society is too large to really affect it, but as long as everyone is aware of these things and you help one person, then that's one less person who's going to be suffering from or suffering as badly from the effects of grief. So it's all about kind of small steps, you know, but it turns into like a 1,000-mile journey or whatever the old Chinese expression is. But yeah, it's one small step to start and then snowball effect from there on, one would hope.
And do you think there are any gender or generational differences on how we approach grief? And has this affected you in any way?
I do think there are differences. And it gets back to something Victoria mentioned earlier. I think that generations who experienced world wars, for example, were taught to just keep calm and carry on and get past the grief that you might have been feeling. In today's society, there is a sense of greater openness and candor, which is a good thing. I do think there's a gender difference. I think women somehow, because the so-called, you know, weaker sex, seem to have more permission to really demonstrate that they're grieving than men do. Men, I think, are supposed to have, you know, a steel spine and just move on. Having said that, I do think for the younger generations, those gender stereotypes and those gender behaviors have broken down a great deal. And I think that's a very healthy thing.
As a late Gen Xer, growing up in the 1980s and 90s, I kind of inherited that stiff upper lip mentality from my father, who incidentally passed away when I was 12. And so, you know, that was the first time I got to try and have said same stiff upper lip. You know, it's very difficult to do that. But ultimately, that's how I behave because that's effectively what I've been taught. And as a result, with the sort of that initial grief, followed by then my mother passed away when I was 20, so about 8 years after my dad. So more grief. And then my brother died 3 years ago, more grief. And that compound effect of grief is a sort of a dangerous thing to carry with you. And I mean that only that it will easily dominate your life. But gender wise, yeah, I've certainly felt that. And actually, it is a gender issue. But you mentioned the sort of effectively phrases or things people tell you that suck. You're the man of the house is one of them. So this is what I get told by, you know, however many adults when I'm 12. And that has stayed with me and its own kind of bed of issues. There's just so much in there that, you know, a young 12-year-old shouldn't have to and doesn't want to deal with. But yeah, it's kind of people putting pressure on you effectively. They want to say something. And so they say that or something similar. And hence the treat me normally side of things as well, because that you don't need to try and placate me with a phrase. We've discussed these things that pop up. But if you can help me in any way, then that's great. But until then, just be a friend and try not to use any phrases that suck.
So our last question, how can an organization support their staff when dealing with grief? And particularly, how can they support those people who are introverted? So maybe they're not showing those feelings.
I've been incredibly lucky with both times I've been going through grief. I've been supported by the organizations I worked for at the time, most recently Delta Capita. I was kind of given the freedom to guide on the space and time I needed. And I think that's what organizations need to do. I understand why policies exist. You can't give everybody weeks off for every single death they might encounter in life. You have to kind of have a cutoff. But I do think treat everything on a case-by-case basis, speak to the individual who is affected, and try where possible and where practical to afford them the space to process very complex feelings. People will go through the five stages of grief, whether they want to or not. They will manifest at some point. And you've got to be aware that some of those stages are quite heavy periods. So the depression, anger, they're just some of the parts of grief. Just affording people, you know, if they're in the anger stage or they're in the depression stage, trust them to take the time to process that and come back stronger. Don't force them to be in situations. And I think the point on introverts, I think it's about line managers really knowing their teams, identifying when someone's an introvert, if they know they've been through a grievance, just offering them options, a non-judgmental space, saying, we would support you if you wanted to go and do this, or if you want to take some time, we will support by offering you paid leave or whatever that looks like. And maybe being more proactive as a manager if you do have introverts in your team.
Would anyone like to add?
Well, I think, well, the only other point I'd say on top of that is that it's kind of crossing over into the world of mental health and so on. But this is something I think DC do particularly well. And that's the medical insurance that we have, the key difference being between policies I've seen before, supposedly comprehensive ones, is they'll put either a cost or a time cap on mental health treatments that you can have. Whereas the AXA one that we have, there isn't that kind of pressure to get all your issues sorted in like 2 or 3 years, because that's when your insurance runs out. You know, it is genuinely a very comprehensive policy. So depending which version people are signed up to, I think that Delta Capita has done all of us employees a real kind of good turn by picking that kind of policy and it being as comprehensive as it is.
Thank you for your vulnerability and sharing. I'm sure our listeners are going to really appreciate your time and everything that you've shared. We're going to move on to the rapid fire question. And I'm sure Diane has answered that many times before. So why don't we start with Diane? And she knows how it's done. So there are three questions that are quite brief and we are looking for brief answers, whatever comes to your mind. So I'll start with the question number one. What's something that people misunderstand about you, Diane?
I think that because I joined Delta Capita as a ESG sustainability professional, people believe that that's been my whole career. But actually, while I have been a career banker, I've had at least a dozen different jobs. Only most recently got involved in sustainability.
What's your favorite self-care that you do for yourself?
I am an avid gardener. And the reason it does good things for my psyche is because when I come into the office in the morning and look at my desk and then toil away all day, it looks exactly the same when I leave at the end of the day. Whereas if I toil for an hour in the garden and stand back and take a look, I get an enormous sense of satisfaction and accomplishment.
And what are the best and worst pieces of career advice that you've received to enable work-life balance?
Worst piece of career advice was to disguise the fact that I was a parent, not mention my children, not have photographs of my children at my desk or on my phone, just disguise the fact that I had parental obligations. Now, keep in mind, this was back in the 90s. Best piece of advice I ever got was an obvious one, which is there's no substitute for working hard, but you need to work smart. And so putting in an extra couple of hours, if you are really focused on doing something that's value add, is worthwhile, but you have to be really smart about how you allocate your time.
Over to you, Victoria. What's something that people misunderstand about you?
I think I've worked on this in the last few years, but I've always had feedback that I have quite an unapproachable face. It is just my face. So I think people just misunderstand it's my face, but trying to soften it. And my favorite self-care is walking my dogs, just being out in nature generally. I always say with a walk, you might not come back feeling better, but you definitely never come back feeling worse. 9 times out of 10, a walk will make you feel better, that connection to nature. And I'm very lucky to have dogs. So I get out regardless of weather. And I'm always so glad I have. And the best and worst pieces of career advice, controversial, but I actually think one of the worst pieces is just work your contracted hours. I do think if you want to progress, sometimes you have to put in that extra work. And part of that is work ethic. And part of that is being flexible when needed. I'm not saying all the time, but I do think there's situations where it really does have merit to go that extra mile if you want to be ahead. Not everybody can be a leader. So you need to set yourself apart. And the best piece of career advice to enable work-life balance, I always think, what do people say on their deathbeds? If something in your gut feels wrong, like you're missing out on something like your kid's sports day or something that you think you'll regret down the line, I would always try and find a way to make that work. So I don't think people on their deathbed say, I wish I'd worked harder and missed more sports days. I do think they say, I wish I'd spent more time with my loved ones on the things that matter. So I think just being really wise to what are your kind of non-negotiables.
And Mark, over to you. What's something that people may not misunderstand about you?
Nothing. I'm an open book to anyone and everyone. No, that's probably it, actually. I'm completely the other way. I mentioned my upbringing and kind of what I learned from that. So as well as all of the kind of individual battles around grief, mental health, etc., I'm also battling myself and my own thoughts about certain things or my own expectations. And you know, there is that kind of the gender stereotype link as well. But yeah, it's that. So what do people misunderstand as well? That, I don't know, I guess I do make a point, not intentionally, of supporting any kind of mental health initiative that is going on, because it's a subject that's near and dear to my heart. And the way I might talk about things, people might get the impression that I know what I'm talking about and I have answers. I don't. It's that simple. I know what's worked for me. I know what things have worked for other people. But I think it is a personal journey, as we've already discussed. And I put a lot of pressure on myself to conform to this old stiff upper lip attitude. And so, like I said, I'm just battling myself when it comes to dealing with those. So
what's your favorite what's your favorite self-care that you do for yourself, some ritual that helps you?
Well, I mean, you said you want whatever comes to mind when you say this. I'm sorry to say that the answer is I don't have one really at the moment anyway. It's something that I'm trying to figure out. You know, it will be beneficial to, you know, myself, my life, and the lives of those around me if my self-care improves. But I really do struggle sometimes to figure out what I will actually kind of enjoy. And sometimes I just feel a bit unenthusiastic about things. But I think it's important to keep an open mind, and you'll figure it out in the end. Hopefully not too close to the end, but you will figure it out.
Sounds like we need to get you a garden and a dog.
Yes, exactly. Believe me, I love dogs. I grew up with them, and I don't at the moment because I'm living in a first floor flat. But
you can borrow my doggy though, Mark, where you borrow other people's dogs and take them on walks.
Oh, is this one of these crazy new social media apps that I love so much that I ignore?
It's a website, actually. It's a website. Good.
Oh,
because you get all the good parts of the dog and then you get it back.
This is very true.
You can put
the mouse
in your building on the wall. Is it the one for the dog I can borrow?
Yes, yeah. I know, walking home or walking back to here in the dark, or the sort of early evening dark, as I did yesterday, we got a vet's office not too far. And I walked, well, I'm on crutches at the moment, so hobbled past a lady who had obviously been there with a chihuahua. And then this thing had like a little coat thing on it, and it had like a neon band around its neck. And I just said to her as she walked past, oh, you're taking him raving. But it's, yeah, it's, I do love dogs. And if I could, I would. I'm just biding my time. So the worst and best pieces of career advice, I guess it's kind of more one in general. And that's, well, I guess it's twofold. First of all, you, as in the royal you, whether it's me or whoever, the only person who's really going to look out for me reliably is myself. So that, you know, it's kind of true in the workplace as well. But it's basically be sensible about things and just realize that you need to blaze your own trail and, well, lead yourself down your own career path, almost not to get distracted by other people. But that's kind of combined with a second piece of advice, which was you can't help anyone else until you've helped yourself, until you're in a good place yourself. So that's as true, you know, in life as it is in work. But those two kind of things, they're not selfish in any way, so long as you don't take it too far. But ultimately, you are the only one who's responsible for yourself. And last thing you want is to be on your deathbed, as you mentioned, like Victoria, and have regrets. So live it to the full, make the most of any opportunity. Worst piece of career advice. It's hard to sort of put it on that. I mean, it's kind of like banal and just otherwise meaningless advice, but I don't think I've been given any advice that really has thrown me. So I guess I'm lucky, but at the same time, I would say I'm unlucky because I haven't figured out a good self-care, you know, method yet. So I up one on one side, down one on the other. So I'll let everyone know when I finally figure it out.
Thank you very much, everyone. A huge thank you that you found the time to discuss this important issue. And well, thank you for listening to this discussion. And please look out for more content from Dr. Capita on our website, drcapita.com, our LinkedIn page, and lastly on our Instagram at delta.capita.